Hello, everyone. This is Edward Song, and welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast. Our virtual studio is packed today, as we have a couple of guests on the show. Danny Anderson of the Sectarian Review podcast is joining us today. The Sectarian Review is one of the other shows in the Christian Humanist Radio Network, and it's dedicated to talking about history, politics, culture, religion, and any other issue that comes up on the cultural landscape. Danny is joined today by his sometimes contributor and a new occasional guest on our own show, Through the Ancient Asides, Jordan Poss. Danny, Jordan, Coyle, and myself will be discussing Hillbilly Elegy, J.D. Vance's recent memoir that has received so much attention in the last year. J.D. Vance grew up in the hills of Appalachian Kentucky and Rust Belt, Ohio, as a working-class kid with all of its now too familiar problems. Divorce and family instability, drug use, violence, poverty, tangles with law enforcement. And while all of these statistics suggest that Vance himself should have been stuck in that cycle, through fortune, grace, and an unusual grandmother, he managed to escape the gravitational pull of that life and go on to the Marines, Ohio State University, Yale Law School, a premier white shoe law firm, and I believe he is now working for a venture capital firm in the Bay Area. It is a remarkable memoir about the virtues and pathologies of the white working class, maybe especially the Scotch-Irish Appalachian white working class, and being published in the same year that Donald Trump was elected as the 45th President of the United States, it offers prescient insight into the group that helped sweep Trump into office. So we will be getting to the episode in a second, but before we begin, I wanted to start with a little announcement for those of you who are going to be in the Southern California area this coming week. The Homebrewed Christianity podcast will be hosting its Theology Beer Camp this week, starting Thursday, January 19th until Saturday, January 21st. The Homebrewed Christianity podcast is something like the most listened to theology podcast on the planet and offers thoughtful interviews and discussions with some of the most interesting figures in contemporary religion. The camp is going to be a mix of delicious craft beer and simulating theology discussions. There will be some talks, a live podcast, nerdy theology discussions by fire pits, and a lot of the hosts of your favorite shows. I myself will be driving down from Santa Barbara to participate. Nathan Gilmore of our flagship Christian Humanist podcast is going to be there as well. The event is in Redondo Beach, California, in Greater Los Angeles. Go to homebrewedchristianity.com for tickets and more information. And now, on to our discussion of Hillbilly Elegy with Danny Anderson, Jordan Poss, Coyle Neal, and myself.
You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island. The Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
And let me begin by introducing our guests, Jordan Poss and Danny Anderson.
Hi, guys.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Great. As always, I'm joined by my regular co-host, Coyle Neal. Coyle?
How's it going, Ed?
Good. It's been a while since we all chatted, and here we are with this big show. Danny Anderson is the host and progenitor of the Sectarian Review. Jordan is a frequent contributor to that show. It's great to have you guys on. Maybe you can just start off. I know a lot of our listeners also listen to the other shows in the network. They listen to your show, Danny. But Danny, maybe you could start off and tell us a little bit about yourself and about your show.
Oh, sure. So I'm Danny Anderson. I teach English at a little place called Mount Aloysius College in Pennsylvania. We're sort of in the middle of the mountains in Pennsylvania near Johnstown and Altoona. And I filled in for about a year, I guess, on the Christian Humanist podcast. And when that stint was up, while Grubbs was finishing his dissertation, they asked me if I wanted to come up with my own little spinoff. And so Sectarian Review, 1 year late, was born. And we're a couple dozen episodes in. We're pushing episode 30 now on that. And so, we talk a mixture of things, politics, culture, a lot of history. We do a lot of religious themes. I talked to a guy about cryptozoology recently. So we do quite a bit of mining of the cultural landscape. And Jordan, of course, is one of my go-to guys that I'd like to talk with.
Yeah. So, Jordan, why don't you introduce yourself as well?
I've been on Sectarian Review a couple of times talking about a few of my own personal demons, I guess, conspiracy theories and that kind of thing. I've also guested now. We've got the first Ancient Asides episode up now about Roman politics for City of Man, which as listeners, as y'all catch those, it'll be very interesting to me to see what our discussion sounds like in this bold new context politically for us, because we recorded those back in what, June and July, something like that, well before the election.
Last summer.
Right. Yeah. So it's been a while. Personally, I am a adjunct instructor of history at Greenville Technical College in Greenville, South Carolina. Also teaching one class this semester at Spartanburg Community College. Wife is Sarah, daughter Sophie, expecting another one, which I guess we can say on the air. I think that's about it for me.
Great. So we all got together. The genesis of this combo episode was the fact that I guess we figured out, I don't even know how we figured this out, that Danny was thinking about doing a hillbilly elegy episode on Sectarian Review. We ourselves, Coyle and I, had been thinking about doing an episode on issues of the white working class for some time that had been on our list. Obviously, one of the amazing things about J.D. Vance's book, it's interesting. I mean, if it had come out in another year, whether it would have got the fanfare and the press accolades that it has, I tend to think that probably would, just because it is such an interesting memoir. But obviously, in a post-Trump political environment, the white working class was sort of the cultural politico issue du jour, and everybody seemed to be talking about Vance's interesting book. Maybe we could start off, and Jordan, if you could just give like a brief summary of explanation of what the book is about, that would be great.
All right, yeah, the book, for those who might have missed it, again, is Hillbilly Elegy, and I believe his subtitle, I don't have it in front of me, I believe the subtitle is A Memoir of a Family and Culture in Crisis by J.D. Vance. Very succinctly, it is a memoir not just of his own life, but of some of the members of his family. It begins with a kind of big picture overview of sort of where his people came from in the old world, and I think we'll have something to say about the Scots-Irish later. A lot of these people, for a variety of reasons, and I think historically, helpfully, he points out that historians cannot agree exactly why this happened this way. A multitude of reasons, probably. His ancestors wound up in the Appalachians and basically stayed there while the rest of the country kind of moved on beyond them. So to this day, the Scots-Irish have a very, very particular set of cultural differences and kind of cultural ideals that set them apart distinctly from the rest of the United States, even the rest of parts of the South, to a certain extent. Speaking specifically of Appalachian kind of hillbilly culture, he gets into his own family talking about his, it doesn't even mention that he had an ancestor who was involved in the Hatfields and McCoys.
Hatfield McCoys, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. He really starts to pick up with his grandparents and their parents. His grandparents, he gives you sort of the story as he learned it, and then the story as it became clear to him as an adult, sort of reinvestigating it and talking to relatives from whom he'd never thought to really even question the story as he had gotten it. Left Kentucky as teenagers and moved to Ohio as part of this kind of great post-war hillbilly migration. Lots and lots of people from the hill country, from West Virginia and Kentucky and places like that, going to more northerly industrial cities. And something my, frankly, Yankee friends have always laughed at me about is that I think of Ohio as the North, right? That to everybody else seems to be just sort of central, you know, that is a sort of normal America, right? But to people like Vance's grandparents, that was, you know, a very different place. But interestingly, he points out that, and I think this is something else we'll talk about again later, they brought that hillbilly culture with them. So there were these kind of Appalachian hillbilly enclaves in what we kind of nowadays term the Rust Belt. Very rough people. Every review that I think I read of this book mentioned his grandmother setting his grandfather on fire. These kind of like hyperbolic threats, right? You come home drunk again, I'm going to kill you. Apparently she was fully capable of acting on a threat like that. Drinking in the past, you know, a couple of generations past, drugs now, high rates of out of wedlock pregnancy, crumbling marriages. When it gets to JD's own life, which makes up the bulk of the book, although it is deeply intertwined with those previous generations because he's mostly raised by his grandmother to read his memoir. He is affected by all of those things, and he's one of the things that impressed me most about his memoir was that this is not a bootstraps kind of rags to riches story like we're used to in the United States. He very eagerly owns up to the fact that statistically speaking, he should be back home in prison, hooked on heroin, fathering, you know, his fourth illegitimate child with, you know, the third woman he's been with in the last 5 years, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
It's important to note for those who aren't familiar with the book that J.D. Vance, despite all of those odds working against him,
yes,
ended up he was in the military. Then he went to Yale Law School, made a number of important professional connections, worked for a very big law firm, and is now doing venture capital in Silicon Valley.
Right, right. Yeah, very, very atypical. We'll talk about our own personal narratives later, but very atypical. And I think he stopped short of calling it a miracle, but he's clearly deeply grateful to the people who kind of, even in their own haphazard and flawed ways, like his grandmother, guided him toward making the right kinds of decisions to sort of escape the what it would seem would be his natural fate as one of the people coming out of this background. Anything mm-hmm. y'all would add to that, summary wise?
I think that's a good summary.
I thought that was good.
Yeah, so it's this very captivating memoir of somebody who grew up in he grew up in Rust Belt, Ohio, but his people are from Appalachia in Kentucky. He went back there at home. He very much identifies with what he calls hillbilly culture, all of the aspects of that are in some ways so attractive, so like the connection to the physical environment back at the family property in Kentucky, the deep sense of loyalty and decency, but at the same time, this very firsthand experience of the pathologies of that culture. His own grandparents tried to escape it in a lot of ways by moving up to Ohio, as did so many other Appalachians looking for work through the course of the 20th century. And just this really vivid chronicle of all of the awesome things about that hillbilly culture, but then a really searingly honest evaluation of all of its pathologies that are all the more stark given the extent to which Vance was able to escape all of that. One interesting thing to me in some ways is that at least a lot of us have sort of personal experiences growing up in those parts of the country. I myself grew up in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains in Central Virginia, in Lynchburg, Virginia. I'm Korean American, so obviously I'm not coming out of Scotch Irish stock. Though some people say that Koreans are like the Irish of Asia. In a certain kind of way, I grew up very familiar with that kind of Appalachian hillbilly culture, even if it wasn't like my own culture. How about you guys?
Well, so this book was actually kind of difficult for me to read for very personal reasons. I mean, this is very, very close to my own personal story, with the exception of the violence. I had a quite stable home life growing up. And so with that exception, and I know it's a major exception, this is a very, very – this maps very closely to my own experience, even down to the state that he's talking about. I recognize a lot of the social failings and issues that he's describing in my extended family to this day. I mean, and so the kind of social difficulties that he's describing, the crime and the drug abuse and all that sort of thing. I don't believe I have any current cousins in prison right now. I think the last one just died. And so I think we're all free right now at this point. But that's a result of much of what he's talking about. I definitely identify quite a bit. Now, we'll get into some, I'm sure, we'll talk about the book more in detail later, I suppose. But there is a key distinction between, I mean, his family's from Kentucky, and mine were from West Virginia. So my family's from sort of north central West Virginia. And he mentions the Dwight Yoakam song, writing Route 23, which is a great song. And it's actually true, because Route 23 goes from Kentucky, where Dwight Yoakam's family is also from, and leads up through Columbus and into like Detroit and all that sort of thing, all those sorts of places. And my family's from West Virginia, and so 77 is the route that leads north there. So when they went north, we ended up in Cleveland and Akron and those sorts of places. So the destinations are important. So he's from Middletown, Ohio, which is sort of right between Columbus and Cincinnati. And I'm from Northeast Ohio, and Cleveland is a much different environment for this hillbilly migration. The experience is significantly different, I think, in some important ways. And so with those exceptions, I really did recognize this story very, very heartily. And I had to sit it down for a couple weeks. Actually, I was on vacation reading it, and I just realized it was going to ruin my vacation. And so I sat it down until I came back to work, which I don't really care if it ruins work. So,
how about you, Jordan? Of the four of us, you're the only one who currently is living in that part of the country.
Well, I am a hillbilly. I am from Rabun County, Georgia, the very northeast corner of the state. Right across the line from South Carolina and North Carolina, and not far from Tennessee. Not in the deepest, darkest hollers of the Apple. I loved his aside about explaining what a holler was, by the way. not set in the deepest, darkest hollers of the Appalachians, but very definitely up there in that. For us, I think just a few days ago, my dad joked that anything south of Gainesville, Georgia, if anybody's familiar with that, anything south of Gainesville or Athens is South Georgia, which is, you know, something like 80% of the state. It's a very different part, and it is, you know, it is really almost like its own entirely different subset of Georgia. Pertinent to, and we'll probably talk about stereotypes later, they shot the movie Deliverance in my hometown. I recognize
that's quite a claim to fame.
Yeah, the banjo boy, I saw him. Well, the banjo boy I saw over Christmas break. He's a greeter at Walmart. And, you know, I recognize the locations in the movie. And, you know, my family has been there. One side of the family has been there since, I want to say, the 1880s. The other moved up in, you know, they started moving up and hanging out in the 1950s, moved permanently in the 60s. But that side of the family also has been in Georgia for 250 years, something like that. So, I mean, deeply rooted in the South generally, but in the mountains in particular. Personally, not, with the exception of, and I think this will be relevant again later, with the exception of maybe one or two small little branches of the family, not actually Scots-Irish, which, Danny, I think you'll have things to say about that later. My mother's side of the family was McKay, but we found out that was a pseudonym. The first McKay in the county was originally a Hobbs, but changed his name after murdering someone in Alabama and fleeing to the hills, which is a great family legend that was proved true about 20 years ago. Other side of the family is Anglo-German. So, I mean, this is very much more about a culture rather than a ethnicity. And you still find traces of that. You know, I live now in Greenville, which is the foothills, the Piedmont in South Carolina, but there are still definitely strong traces of that kind of culture and lifestyle around here. And I see it every day among my students and even just driving around the area.
Mm-hmm. Coyle, you grew up in Montana, but was there any personal resonance for you on the?
Yeah. So, I mean, my family obviously originally came from the East Coast because all of the Europeans who moved here hit the East Coast, but, they moved west and didn't stay in the Appalachians. That said, My mother's side of the family is originally from the Ozarks, which is where I live now, sort of right in the foothills. And the culture there is very similar, right? So maybe hillbillies instead of rednecks, or I'm not sure what the right slang terms are, but still a very similar culture. And where I grew up in Montana, very heavily white working class, with the exception of the Native American cultures here and there. There are similarities. The difference is where I grew up, it is a mix of industrial is not the right word, but mining communities and agriculture. And I think agricultural working class tends to be a little bit different. Some ways in ways that are better, and some ways in ways that are worse. If nothing else, the agricultural working class can really never be out of work. Like if you have animals, you have to feed them, and it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter if they don't pay anything. It doesn't matter if you're feeling down. It doesn't matter if you're sick or if it's a Sunday or if it's a holiday or whatever. You still have to go out and do the work. So some of the stories that he shared about people who would like get jobs and then just not show up or sit on their porch and complain about things while collecting welfare. I certainly knew people like that, but that did not define the culture. There is that work ethic that takes a lot longer to die off. Now, the other side of that might be that just because I grew up in the West, it's a younger culture. So maybe 100 years from now, it'll look a lot like Appalachia does.
Yeah. This is something that I know that you all wanted to talk about, but one of the super interesting things to me is that it describes a culture whose locus point is primarily in the South. But then the whole story of this Appalachian migration wasn't something historically that I was particularly familiar with, but it certainly described my experiences. Like, you know, so when I went away from home and went to college, you can be in parts of what everybody would call the northern state, parts of Pennsylvania, parts of New York, even going into the Midwest, parts of Illinois that like feel like the South. And what he describes also just sort of like he's describing the South to me, not just the particular culture of a people who trace their ethnic roots back to Scotland and Ireland. So one of the big issues that's come out of it is the extent to which, you know, he's talking about an ethnicity or a culture, and just what the white working class that he's describing is actually refers to.
Yeah, I actually think that leads me to some of my criticisms of this book, and I don't want to start by criticizing a book that I liked, but I do feel like he's inventing an ethnicity that's handy as a way to kind of talk about the way that cultural problems are handed down through generations. And so he invents a version of Scots-Irish stuff that is, I don't know how factual it is. I would like to see actual historians talk about this. I've done a little bit of research in doing this, all is doing some genealogy of my own. I had a great grandfather, R.P. Anderson, who was 92 when he died and never told anybody anything. And so our kind of family history just sort of ended with him, right? And so I started looking into his story, and I was able to dig pretty deep all the way into Ireland and Northern Ireland. And so I don't know, a little background, and Jordan will probably be able to fill in any gaps I leave, and I'll leave him freedom to do that. But the Scots-Irish are not like Scottish people and Irish people who intermarry in America, right? It's a migration of Protestants from Scotland into Northern Ireland when the British were trying to de-Catholify, essentially, Ireland. And so they brought all these other Protestants who were not Anglican, right? They're Presbyterian. And so that they brought with them kind of a conflict with the British ruling class. And so after a few generations in Northern Ireland, as Protestants even, they felt themselves kind of oppressed by British penal laws, the religious laws that were also being used against Catholic Irish. And so the people who then left Northern Ireland with this Scottish heritage, somewhat religious heritage as well, ended up going into sort of Philadelphia, Delaware River ports because of as I've come to find out, that's just where the boats were going because of the flax trade. And they would get on these boats because they were already heading to these ports. And they got off there. They kind of over time spread along the spine of the mountain. They got to the Appalachians as they went through Pennsylvania. As soon as they hit the mountain range, they were looking for farmland. Mm-hmm. And so they would spread along, like, that's sort of the border. It's a while before they enter into the mountains, kind of. And so by the time these communities are established that Vance is talking about, it's not just this one people group, and they don't have that strong of a ethnic identity. They just consider themselves farmers, right? And after a while, you know, they start mechanizing coal mines, and you have industry being built up. And so I feel like this attempt to sort of attach an ethnicity to this culture doesn't feel right to me on some level. I feel like that's a weakness in the book. His descriptions of the culture that is there, I think, are spot on. I think the genealogy and other things are sort of wrong with it. But Jordan probably can fill in the history of the Scotch-Irish more than I've just done. Before I send it off to him, though, the reason I think that flaxseed trade is so interesting, it's established routes determining where people go, just as later on, if you're in West Virginia, it's Route 77 determining where you go, right? And so I made a little documentary years and years ago in another life about this, and that was kind of the thesis of – that was the kind of thing I kind of focused on, because I thought that was just a really interesting kind of material condition that that dictated this migration more than any kind of spiritual or kind of – these Jeffersonian ideas of freedom or anything like that, right? There's like material reasons that they went where they went. And so, but I turned it over to Jordan.
Yeah, no, go ahead. Yeah.
I want to push back just a little bit on that. And like you guys, it's been a while since I had read the book. But my takeaway was that he was focusing more on the economic class rather than the ethnicity. Like, so yes, they are white, but more importantly, they are white and poor. So yeah, he does talk about the Scots-Irish a bit, but again, my impression was not he is focusing on, hey, we're white people and this is our culture. It's we are poor people living in this particular area. This is our culture.
Yeah.
I agree with that, and I think that that's where he should have gone. I think he tries to romanticize it with the Scotch-Irish stuff, and I also think that allows him to make an argument, this sort of culture of poverty kind of argument. And so he's talking about things that are handed down generationally, right? And I agree with you, Coyle. I think that's really what he's interested in, is this sort of white poverty in these communities. But I think he sets that up in a wrongheaded way. And I really want to limit my critique to that setup. That's all I meant. You're right. You're entirely right that his emphasis is the culture that exists, the economic culture that exists.
Jordan, you want to chip in on this?
Yeah. I just kind of processing what Danny and Coyle have just said. Danny, I thought your brief explanation of how the Scots-Irish wound up here was excellent. I don't really have a whole lot to add to that. I'd say the economic and the material and the kind of lust for freedom sort of interpretations are not necessarily mutually exclusive. That's the thing, is they are so like deeply intertwined. And you see this, for instance, in let me back up a little bit. So we've got these, you know, this influx of Scots-Irish people among many, many others, right? Because there's lots of English people coming in as well. And my own roots are primarily German and English, with little flecks of like Welsh and Scots in there. And yet, again, hillbilly. So I think it might have been more helpful if he had just noted the Scots-Irish influence and hung more on the label hillbilly, as derogatory as it is. I think it would be a better catch-all. But you've got these big.
Can I interrupt, Jordan? In some way, just to verify what you're saying, in some ways, the term Scots-Irish is an invention of people who don't want to be thought of as Irish. Because when the Catholic Irish basically starts immigrating to America in the more industrialized part of the economy, they weren't even considered white,
right?
And so I think a lot of people, the term Scots-Irish has its genesis in this attempt to distinguish themselves from the proper Irish that are coming over, right? And so, yeah, I think that the term itself is very slippery and almost useless.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that too, because I mean, I think it's also at least partially involved in this kind of late 19th century awakening of nationalist impulses in people. And you see this in particular. I mean, one of my primary interests is, you know, the American Civil War, and growing up, you know, in the Appalachians, hearing all about, you know, the Confederates were better soldiers because there were these tough Scots-Irish guys, you know, and they grew up in the woods hunting, and, you know, they were Scots-Irish, and they, you know, they had this like continuous linear heritage from, you know, William Wallace and people like that, of these tough warriors. And, you know, there's maybe a little to that, you know, to this kind of overarching ethos, but it was deeply blended, you know, with elements of the English aristocracy and, you know, the poor among them. And we'll have more to say about the poor later. And so what struck me in reading a lot of stuff from the period of the Civil War is nobody makes any bones about Scots-Irish anything. You know, it's like, I'm a Georgian, I'm a Carolinian, I'm a Kentuckian, you know, or maybe I'm a Southerner or whatever. The Scots-Irish thing is kind of superimposed on this kind of Southern heritage later as sort of a, I don't want to say phony, but this kind of very, I'm trying to find exactly the right qualifier to use here. It's sort of superimposed. It's this kind of, I used to hate this term, meta-narrative that's been created now and reimposed on the past. So, I mean, if you had grabbed some guy, even a guy with a name like McKay, out of the Appalachian Mountains in 1840, and, you know, his family had lived up there since, you know, maybe the Revolution. Maybe they were some of the poor who had kind of flooded out of the Tidewater and up the Piedmont into the mountains because that was all that was left. And maybe they were even provoking the Indians by crossing the Proclamation Line, right? The Proclamation of 1763. If you had grabbed him after several generations of having lived there, he probably wouldn't have known what you were talking about, right? He would have spoken English. He would have spoken it with some kind of what we would have recognized probably by that point as a Southern accent, making air quotes here. That Scots-Irish nationalist identity comes along later. I feel like I've kind of gone off on a rabbit trail on this. It's a fascinating thing, but you're right that it's very key to the way that they conceive of themselves. And again, I heard lots of this Scots-Irish stuff growing up, even down to seemingly silly things like trying to explain where the Confederate flag comes from. And that's something Danny and I have talked about. You know, it's got the blue St. Andrew's cross, and they're like, oh yeah, that's an adaptation from the Scottish flag because there are so many Scots-Irish Confederate soldiers. And the more mundane reality is, no, it's just easy to see on a battlefield. I mean, it's very easy to see. You know, just look for the big blue X through all the smoke and follow that.
Right. So there's like they're trying to impose romanticism. I feel like I've taken over you guys' show. I'm so sorry about this. This is just something I thought about a lot. It's much more inspiring to come up with this historical heritage that explains the Confederate flag. And if you're Scotch-Irish, I mean, that migration happened in the 16 and 1700s in America, and you no longer have a real connection to that identity. So it is something, you're just generically American.
Yeah. Right?
You have no ethnicity.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, this very point has I've seen people raise this worry in reviews, and the extent to which this story about these fiercely independent Protestant Scots, you know, who fought under William Wallace against the British, so they're fiercely independent. They are naturally prejudiced against institutions and hierarchy. You know, they grew up herding sheep in the hills of Scotland, so they had this sort of natural connection to the land. And then they came to the United States, and they wandered into Appalachia, which looked just like Scotland and Ireland, and continued those values. Like, you know, a lot of people, there are lots of people who sort of criticize that as being a kind of a manufactured mythology. But both of those criticisms don't need to be false. I mean, to me, again, one of the interesting things about the book is that it's like it's describing a culture that's like very familiar to me growing up in the South. Like, right. He's not just describing hillbillies from Appalachia. He's describing the South. Mm-hmm. and you know, and now why is the South that way? And then you can kind of tell a story about how that kind of hillbilly culture, it's not just describing a particular ethnic people, but it might have its roots in that ethnic people, but it clearly has those kinds of cultural values have now transcended people of a very specific ethnic heritage. I mean, one thing that he doesn't talk about is like the African American hillbilly. Mm-hmm. And there, you know, there are going to be a lot of black people who grew up in the South and like, yeah, that's my culture, and my relatives can't be traced back to William Wallace.
Right.
One of the other, there's this, I don't know if you guys know this book from the social psychologist Richard Nisbet. Nisbet is, he's a social psychologist at Michigan. He's written like the two most stunning books of academic work that I've like ever read in any discipline. He wrote a book called The Geography of Thought, which is like all about, it's like a psychological analysis of the way that Asians and Westerners think about things. Just talking about how deeply culture informs our cognitive outlook on the world. But then he wrote this other book called Culture of Honor. The subtitle of that book is The Psychology of Violence in the South. And what he's interested in is just like when you look at Southern states, and really, you know, if you look at the map, it's not just Southern states, but it's Southern states, including sort of going up all up that Appalachian chain, and then also including all of those states that were part of the Appalachian migration. When you just look at the statistical data, those places are more violent than other places. So, you know, he's approaching this as a kind of a social scientist and thinking, huh, this is weird. People from these places are more violent than people in other parts of the country. And the United States as a whole is more violent than a lot of other places in the world. Why is that? And then Nisbet tells this story about, well, it's because in these places you find this very specific kind of culture of honor, right? And he tells this story sort of going back to the Scottish Highlands. And when you live in the Highlands, given the nature of like sheep herding, because sheep, it's hard to take somebody's property, but it's easy to take their sheep. And living under social and political structures and that kind of agricultural society, like that kind of culture of honor sprung up as a kind of mechanism for ensuring social order. You know, so there's a really high premium set on virtues and norms of honor. And then correspondingly, there's a kind of embrace of violence as a way of reinforcing that. And so, you know, whether this historical ethnic story is just a kind of a mythology or what, it is really clear that just, I mean, culturally speaking, there are things that are distinctive about the particular terrain that Vance is talking about.
Oh, yeah. And something you said that reminded me of something the Coen brothers actually said about Fargo back in the day, asking why they wanted to write a movie about just these people in the middle of nowhere in Minnesota. They said, well, Minnesotans are very polite, and they had found that polite societies are the most violent societies. So, I mean, yeah. I've got so many things, kind of like so many currents. Let me try to fashion something out of this. Talking about the Scottish and their code of honor, right? That is not completely alien to their English neighbors. We've got to remember that, again, the predominant people on the eastern seaboard, the predominant group of people settling the eastern seaboard in the north and the south at first are going to be English, but you can further subdivide it from there. And a book I would point to, I haven't read the entire thing because it's mammoth, but I've dipped into it a lot, is David Hackett Fisher's Albion Seed, in which Fisher kind of digs into four major, you know, he doesn't just look at the Isle of Britain. He kind of breaks it down. So, you know, we would nowadays talk about white people. You know, we could further subdivide that into, you know, Europeans, into people from the British Isles. And then he finally whittles it down to four major kind of what he calls folkways, which I think is a pretty handy term rather than like ethnicity or, you know, kind of larger culture. These four different folkways, which wind up in different pockets of the eastern seaboard, whether the Appalachians, the kind of southern tidewater, sort of the middle Atlantic and the New England, right, where the Puritans wind up. And he sees those as kind of laying some of the foundations for the very broad cultural differences later. And, of course, those have to go through – and I didn't want to harsh too much on some of that Scots-Irish mythology, because there is something to it. There is something to it, but it is deeply, deeply intermingled. And then, you know, America has always been a melting pot, even among different kinds of white people. So in the South in particular, you still have things like that chivalric code of honor among the English, mm-hmm. and, you know, the more clannish, Scots-Irish code of honor. And
that's clannish with a C, right? Not clannish with a K.
Correct. The clan with the K.
Just to clarify.
The clan with the K, contrary to reports, is not super active in the South anymore. I think one of Rabun County's last clansmen died a few years ago, and his funeral was not widely attended. But I think other, even beyond simple things like honor, I think other cultural factors need to be factored in there as well. Like, again, clannishness. Something I identified with very strongly in Vance's book, and that you could trace to either the Scots or possibly the English, given the nature of heredity in a aristocratic society. The very, very intense familial bond, right? And the way I even joke about this with my students when I explain people like the Greeks and the Romans. You know, if you insult one member of a redneck family, a truck arrives with who? And they all laugh, and it's like, you know, all of his cousins, right? I think that clannishness is one of the distinctives that can help us sort of separate out, you know, sort of suss out some of the very distinct characteristics of these very slippery groups. I had put in our show notes, and I think I could bring this up here. You know, we've talked about Scots-Irish, we talked about hillbillies and Southerners. I've also got the terms white trash and redneck in here. It's useful, I think, because as Coyle rightly pointed out, Vance isn't just talking about a racial or ethnic group. He's talking about specifically the poor of that group. And this is where my own experience as a hillbilly kind of departs a good deal from Vance's. We didn't have a lot, but we never trashed a pharmacy because the pharmacist was rude to our kid. None of our relatives, you know, there have been episodes of violence, but nothing on the order of what he described.
So far.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Your children are young still, yeah. Jordan. There's time for you to take up your...
Well, you know, Sophie did hit me in the face with a book the other day, so...
Did you set her on fire?
No. No.
That's an episode from the book, for those of you...
Right. Yeah, maybe I should elaborate. He recounts several stories specifically about his grandparents. In one case, his uncle wanted to look at a toy that was on display in a pharmacy that was kind of the sought-after toy for Christmas that year. This was in the early 50s, if I remember his chronology right. The pharmacist told him he couldn't play with it because it was too expensive, and if he broke it, you know, that would be a loss for the store, and they kicked him out of the pharmacy. So when his parents came along, he told them what had happened, and his parents, that is JD's grandmother and grandfather, went inside, cussed out the pharmacist, threw stuff off of the shelves, broke things, made a huge... I start to slip into my native language here. Made a scene, right? They were being ugly. And then immediately took their kid and continued chopping as if nothing had happened. That is something unimaginable from the members of my family, even though we share a lot of very broad similarities with Vance and his family. And that is where... I don't know how often he uses the term white trash in the book, but that's an important marker, even between people of who are all broadly speaking what we would call hillbillies. Mm-hmm. You got to act like you have a certain kind of class, right? And a big part of that is, you know, to go to Russell Kirk here, prudence. People of a certain station are going to know which battles to fight, which hills to die on. White trash, fight everybody. You know, they are continuously violent rather than picking their battles and, you know, letting certain things go for, you know, where someone of a higher, I hate to use station because that makes it sound like they're better off. Someone who is a hillbilly but not white trash would let something go because it would be the honorable thing to do, where a white trash person would fight somebody because they thought that was the honorable thing to do. They're acting from roughly the same motive in wildly different ways. In my own experience, I would probably have come from that. He talked about other hillbillies who were weirdly nice, right? And I don't know if he explicitly makes this connection, but it seemed like most of the ones he described that way were the ones who more frequently went to church. You know, like was it his actual dad who was just weirdly, his biological father who was,
right.
Yes. You know, he kind of describes as being strangely nice and, you know, going to church all the time and that kind of thing. That resonated a lot more with me than JD's direct experience, although I knew a lot of people like JD's family. Does any of that, I feel like I've gone on way too long here. Does all of that make sense to y'all?
Yeah. So it's a difference in, it's a difference of temperament, not of income or of social standing or anything like that. Right. There are,
yeah.
And again, I saw, I'm sort of in the same boat as you, where I grew up exceptionally poor, in the mountains, no less, but absolutely no concept of trashing a store because they weren't even mean to him. Right. I mean, it was just a, don't touch this because we don't want you to break it, which is a perfectly reasonable thing for a store owner to say. And I mean, my parents would have, you know, totally backed up the manager of the store on that.
Yeah.
Like that. And had I actually broken it, you know, my parents would have murdered. No, they wouldn't have murdered me, but they would have, you know, I would have been the one in trouble.
Right.
So yeah, they're, but like you, I also knew people who were more of that other kind of temperament
right.
who that sort of thing would not have been okay. Right. That sort of, disproportionate reaction to a circumstance, anyway, yeah. So
yeah, it's.
And I'm.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, I'm not entirely sure what I think about that yet. I'm not sold on everything he says as to the causes of that, but it's still interesting to see that kind of worked out.
Yeah.
What do you think he thinks the causes are, Coyle? Like, what? I can't really tell why he thinks they are the way they are. Like, what do you think about that?
I think it comes down to the culture that you say doesn't exist, right? It's the
name.
The cycle of, well, no, it's the way he grew up. He sees the way he grew up. Other people, of course, grew up in the same setting. He talks about being lucky to have escaped it where no one else or few other people were able to do so. But when that's what you grow up with and that's what you see, it's hard not to be that sort of person, right? So his tendencies to violence that he talks about towards the end of the book, well, they're reflections of what he saw in his mother, what he saw in extended family members, what he saw in his grandparents, who I think are by and large some of the most sympathetic people in his family are, mm-hmm. are the grandparents. But even they, like you say, they're the ones who trash the pharmacy. So there's that culture and that family where you have some good values being passed on, you know, loyalty to family, but you also have these other behaviors, these other temperaments. And I don't know enough about, you know, biology or psychology to start talking about genetics. Presumably a child adopted into that family would grow up with similar inclinations. Right. At least that was my impression, was that this is a problem that is built into the structure of that particular aspect of hillbilly culture or that side of hillbilly culture. Cause like mm-hmm. Jordan said, it's not all hillbillies, and JD Vance just didn't grow up in contact with the other sorts.
Mm-hmm. Well, the really striking thing to me, I mean, that there was violence in his household and in his community obviously wasn't surprising, but it was like the embrace and valorization of it. That was like shocking to me. And, so there are all these, you know, so it's, he got into fights when somebody would insult his sister or his mother or his grandmother, he would get in fights. There's a story of his grandmother setting his grandfather on fire. You know, there's stories about vigilante justice being done in the community, but like the valorization of that kind of violence, it was shocking to me. It was just shocking to me.
And I guess I disagree with this book more than I thought I did coming out and talking about it here. I mean, so I think you're right, Coyle. I think he puts it down to just sort of, this is the environment I grew up in. And he doesn't ask why the environment is like that. And so like Ed is saying, so his grandparents did the violent stuff in the pharmaceutical store when they lived in Kentucky. Right. That was a Kentucky story, if I remember right. And in the Middletown, they're kind of much more well-adjusted people. Right. And I feel like, what is the difference then between Kentucky and Middletown? It's not just the people. Right. And I feel like There's a difference. But my parents, so about half my family stayed in West Virginia and about half moved north to Cleveland. And my parents were among that other half. And there's a difference between the way I was raised and the way that the folks who stayed down there were raised. It isn't there's got to be some sort of economic factor, I guess is what I'm getting at, as to why people don't – why people are take the law into their own hands like Ed is saying. I'm pointing
– He's pointing at me for those of you not on Skype with
him. Sorry. And it looks terrible in my video here. But why are they resorting to that kind of violence? Yeah. Because they don't trust the institutions of justice that the community provides, right? And when you're in a bigger city, you have police that you can call, which they do, right? And so I feel like there's also – there's not just a cultural thing. There are like whole economies that are different that he doesn't want to acknowledge.
I know that –
You're meaning economies in sort of the broad sense, right? Not just slightly more money on the part of one set of the hillbilly culture and not –
Right.
The so, whole like, transactions. For a second there, I was going to be like, man, you're going full Marxist on us here.
Well, I think there's some of that, but yeah, but it's also institutions in general, right? There are sort of like economies is in the sense of the way that human beings interact with one another.
I don't know that I would agree with, and again, he doesn't, because it is a memoir, he doesn't talk about the side of the hillbilly culture that he didn't grow up in, right? The more benign less violent side. But I don't know that I would say that that side of the culture necessarily is more trusting of institutions or the government. Maybe more respectful, right? I mean, maybe they're less likely to shoot at the IRS agent who comes to, you know, check stuff out in the house. But it's not that they love that IRS agent any more than the other side does.
Yeah.
So again, where does that leave, you know, the cause of the difference? I don't know. It's not like you have this, you know, government loving side of hillbilly culture versus the government hating side of it. It's, they all hate it. It's just some of them are more, and I think it might be what both Jordan and the book say is there is a religious streak, that maybe divides the two. That was really the only thing, at least in the book, that jumped out as being the source of the difference.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a part of it, but like we're talking about cultural values, and it's not as if cultural values are rigid and uniform. I mean, they're going to describe a certain set of values, say, you know, familial loyalty, honor, maybe suspicion of outsiders or suspicion of like formal governmental institutions. And then those are just going to manifest themselves in different ways for different people. For one thing, they're not going to be confined to the specific ethnicity or historical lineage from whence those cultural values might have come from. So again, you have non-Scotch-Irish Southerners for whom they're like, yeah, that's me. That's my value. Or even African-Americans who are like, yeah, that's me. And then again, I mean, the cultural value. So a lot of people grew up in hillbilly culture and they just – that kind of the importance of honor never manifested itself in violence, but you know, in other pockets of that culture, concern for one's own honor and the honor of one's family quickly means that if I'm insulted, it's going to be on like Donkey Kong.
Well, even with that, I and Jordan, you can speak to this more than I can because I. Where I grew up, it is that honor line doesn't exist in the West. Just like that, religious influence is not nearly as strong. But again, my impression of the I guess I hate to call them the good side of hillbilly culture, but the less violent side of hillbilly culture isn't that they're afraid of fighting for honor. Right? It's not that you don't fight someone who calls your sister an awful name. Again, it's that disproportionate response. Right? There are insults that you let slide by. Right. There are times when someone cuts you off in traffic and you don't run them off the road and scream at them and maybe take a shot at them. Right. And so it's not even a lack of violence. Maybe it's a greater sense of wisdom or prudence or what have you about when to use the violence, when it's appropriate.
Right.
Anyway, I should let you talk about this, Jordan. This is your part of the country.
I think you're absolutely right there. It's I've been trying to find a way to more explicitly kind of lay this out, but whether it's let me make an observation I was going to mention earlier, and that's that white trash, as it is, at least in my own experience. And again, this is coming from a corner of Appalachia, and there are very broad, you know, Appalachia hillbilly culture is very broad with lots and lots of subsets and sub pockets. It's handy to talk about the overarching group because there are lots of things in common, but there are a lot of differences. So speaking from my own personal experience anyway, the way the term white trash is used is more often than not a moral judgment rather than something strictly economic. So there could be people of exactly the same economic standing, right? Maybe they both live in trailers, but one of them is trash and one of them is not. And that has a lot to do with how they behave. Right. I was reading a history of just the term white trash, the descriptions going back actually to England in like the 17th century are striking. Loose, promiscuous girls who get sexually active at a very young age, don't care about their living quarters, live in squalor and filth, shabby clothing, poor speech, uneducated. Very often physically malformed. Lots and lots of descriptions of lantern-jawed hillbillies, even as far back as the 1700s, and that's something that, you know, you can see in any Appalachian nursing home now is the people with this kind of pronounced jaw for whatever reason. All of those things in common. Those things describing white trash. People who are not white trash will still probably be very physically similar, but they will be very morally different, right? And I think wisdom and prudence have a lot to do with that. You know, which fights do you pick and which do you let slide? A term that Vance uses throughout his book that is very common in American English but has special significance in hillbilly culture anyway is mean. Mean doesn't just mean schoolyard bully, right? And at least where I'm from, mean is loaded with a certain kind of moral freight that a mean person, somebody who does something just for meanness, right, for the sake of meanness, is morally degraded, right? They are low. They're making morally deficient decisions on purpose very often.
It's Flannery O'Connor's Misfit.
Yes.
A Good Man Is Hard to Find. He actually says there's a meanness in this world.
Right. Yeah, and that is not just, again, we all use the word mean, and, you know, meanie heads kind of a schoolyard way to describe a bad person. But in the South, and what O'Connor, I think, brilliantly brings out in that story is what meanness means to a Southerner, right? It's a kind of very low moral standing that's going to manifest itself not just in one or two particular ways, let me put it this way. It's not just going to manifest in violence. It's going to manifest itself in particular kinds of violence and very unfiltered kinds of violence. Because, you know, my dad is one of the most peaceable people that I know, but he does own a gun, just in case. Because there are some things that must be responded to if necessary, you know. I don't think I ever got in a fight as a kid. But I know that there are things out there that would provoke a violent response from me, just coming out of that culture. The difference is that the kinds of hillbillies that J.D. Vance is describing are going to respond, you know, with the nuclear option to everything, right? From the smallest kind of schoolyard insult to an actual assault on your person. There's no filter on it. There is no... I think Coyle used the word proportionate, right? Their responses are not going to be properly proportioned. Does any of that make sense?
If I didn't use that word, I should have. So let's go with that.
I think you did.
I wonder if, and maybe this is just like the cop out, easy way out. But you know, I'm all about the easy way out. Is maybe the difference between the two sides of the hillbilly culture? Can we just reduce that to drugs and or alcohol? I mean, that's certainly a theme through the book, right? His mother and even him, although he doesn't talk as much about it, it's sort of in passing, and you have to be paying attention to catch it. But there are times when he talks about, you know, he got in trouble at school and it's because he'd been drinking, or when his mom wanted the clean urine for the drug test that she wanted to cheat on, he was like, "Well, I've been doing drugs."
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, that's a factor. I would, and again, I don't want to go back to, you know, and I don't like, I think I'm on the record in several places of not liking monocausal explanations, but I think religion is an important thing there because teetotalism has actually hung on in Appalachia where it's died out in a lot of other places.
Right.
So, I mean, mm-hmm. I grew up never drinking, never really seeing any family members drink at family gatherings, but there was a lot of drinking that went on in other families that I knew. And very often those were going to be somewhere closer to or even over that white trash, plain old hillbilly divide. So yeah, there were certain parts of, at least in my home county, you know, there were kind of these sort of roadhouse joints that seemed to change ownership every 18 months, mm-hmm. where a particular kind of person, not that much different culturally from us, but probably going to go to the bar instead of church, if that makes sense.
Well, that's
alcohol and substance abuse has a lot to does have a lot to do with it, I'm sure. And I think eroded religious underpinnings, you know, the kind of religious kibosh on things like even something as simple as beer, because, you know, again, the kind of Fundy Baptist environment I was raised in, you know, it was zero alcohol whatsoever. There were people who were more lenient on that, but typically of a slightly higher class. Drugs, though, is the one that I've personally seen more of. And I've got cousins and uncles I could name who had prospering businesses and then got into drugs and became trash, you know, in their own siblings and cousins' judgments.
Right. And
does that kind of answer your question where you were going with,
yeah, and,
with that?
Yeah, and I've seen the same thing both where I live now and where I grew up, although again where I grew up the hillbilly terms don't really apply quite the same way. But you can basically see the difference between the people who fit the one category and the people who fit the other, and often the people who fit the more violent category or again whatever we're calling that subcategory, drugs and alcohol will follow along, or they'll cause the difference. I don't know which comes first, but they will. Mm-hmm. They will certainly be.
It's a chicken and egg thing,
right? And I mean, it's not even like you can say, well, they're really violent, but at least they don't drink, or they're really violent, but at least they don't do drugs. I mean, they certainly go together. Again, I don't know that I'd like you. I don't know that I'd want to take the monocausal approach, but it's got to be a huge factor. I mean, it has to be.
Yeah, and it's also intertwined, you know, all these elements are so tightly woven together. It's impossible, I think, to really successfully separate out just one strand of it and kind of follow it. It's going to interact. I mean, I think one of y'all was about to say something. I'll throw this out there and then step back for a few minutes. Right before I got married and moved to the upstate South Carolina, I was on grand jury in my home county, and probably 90% of the cases that we heard were involved drugs. Meth in some cases, but actually prescription drugs more often than not.
Right.
And I think there's little hints of that throughout Vance's story. At least I, you know, could certainly sort of read my own experiences into that and see it sort of lurking in the background. With his mom being a nurse, very probably she had access to that kind of stuff and could have been pilfering it. Lots of people driven, right, in their terms, to commit crimes because they're hooked on pain pills, you know, in this kind of economically hard hit area. Sorry, what were y'all going to say?
Yeah, I'd just say the same thing. I'll just say it's exactly the same thing in Southwest Missouri. I was talking to the federal judge for our district, and he said something like 70% of the cases that he presides over are drugs, usually either meth or prescription somethings. Exactly the same situation here.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, I mean, obviously add drugs and alcohol to the mix, it's not probably going to make things better. But it's also clear that, like, a lot of that violence, I mean, the disproportionate violence springs out of an honor culture, right? And so a verbal slight in some ways is just a verbal slight. But a slight against one's honor is an unforgivable sin. Like, that's the whole point behind an honor culture. And it's clear that, like, as he's talking about the history of his family, that kind of violence predates a lot of the alcohol abuse that entered into it later on. Though a big part of a big part of the story also includes the rather robust history of alcohol abuse in his immediate family.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I think they're pretty intertwined. I don't know that you can you know, put one before the other, at least not in the book. Because, yeah, he talks about his uncles, right? The who are they? Not the Clantons.
Blanton.
Blanton, yes, Blantons.
Yeah.
Blantons.
Because he talked a lot about Mamaw Blanton.
Right. So, I mean, they were, yes, they were violent, but weren't they? They were also moonshiners, right? I mean, they were. So, again, it's you can't pull the two apart and say, well, they're just violent, but then alcohol exacerbates it. No, it's both, right? They're together. And that's not me as a Baptist speaking. I'm just saying, I think he presents the two sort of side by side.
One thing.
Yeah. And I thought of, sorry.
No, go ahead, Jordan.
I thought of moonshine about 30 seconds before you mentioned it. My, you know, speaking from my own experience here, but kind of tying back, his book reminded me so much of stories I heard from great uncles, right? You know, my granddad, when he was a little boy, was used as a lookout for a relative. He never said which relative, but a relative's still during one of the lakes in our county, you know. The one time he ever got drunk, he was in the Air Force and somehow got a hold of a submachine gun and drove into the little Korean village near his airbase and just started shooting the buildings up. He's, you know, I heard that story from my mother and grandmother, not him. And, you know, their big takeaway was, you know, thank God he didn't actually shoot anybody. After that, zero alcohol. So, I mean, it's, you know, they are totally intertwined. And to speak about honor, I mean, there are something that tends to be overlooked in discussions about honor culture is that there are honorable, nonviolent ways to fix problems. And those are usually, let me put it this way. For non-white trash people of an honor culture, the nonviolent ways are the go-to, you know, and you kind of walk through certain steps. In my U.S. history class, I will, just as kind of a fun activity, I will walk my students through the stages of a duel in the way that it was kind of practiced in, you know, say the 1820s, 18-teens. And the duel is the last step, right? After you've exhausted all the other possibilities, right? You demand an apology, and if the person will not apologize, you know, because sometimes people give offense without meaning to. And, you know, an honorable man will apologize for that. And both sides will have their honor satisfied and they'll part ways at peace. People from Vance's subset of the culture, though, would immediately respond with violence, right? Those other options don't exist. And that is a key difference within the broader Southern culture that kind of sets apart, again, this sort of lower or meaner mindset. Does that make any kind of sense?
Yeah, though, I mean, there's certainly occasions in which the recognition of wrongdoing deflates an opportunity for violence.
Yeah.
But like, again, but one of the characteristic things about honor cultures are that personal slights are nuclear events.
Right. What I'm saying is that, you know, you've always got that trigger there in an honor culture with the subset of the culture Vance is writing about. It's a hair trigger. Right. So, I mean, that possibility is always there, even among the, you know, more high class hillbillies or whatever, however we want to describe them. But they are not going to resort to it maybe as quickly, where Vance, you know, for people of his ilk, it's always going to be that way. And, you know, I can think of stories now that I've heard from my own grandparents about their relatives who much better fit that description, where my own experience has been of the more weirdly nice variety. Again, still hillbillies, but with that key difference manifesting itself in that, not a lack of a willingness to fight, but the immediate violent response.
I wanted to get back to the point that Danny was making earlier about whether this was all culture or whether it was economics and the material conditions, because I mean, that's a point that I've seen a lot of people make, and a lot of people have said in reviews of the book that he's attributing too much of the specific pathologies that surrounded him when he's growing up to culture, when it was really just a matter of poverty. Danny, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, one particular, critique I've read of it, and I've come to agree a bit, is that he's really kind of picking up Daniel Patrick Moynihan's culture of poverty notion. I mean, he's just taking it from African-American communities into this white community. But one thing to keep in mind about the region he's talking about, he's not talking about Appalachia is different than the South, right? One major thing that makes it different is its natural resources. And so that is a region that has been used by the economy, right? So industrialists move into these places, strip it bare, and leave it stripped, right? And so people of that region have over time become very distrustful of outsiders, right? And I happen to live in one again today, and we're in sort of former coal country in Pennsylvania, and people are very reticent to accept outsiders because there's a distrust. And I think a lot of the cultural traits that he's describing in this book are true. I mean, I recognize them, right? And the only thing I'm sort of taking exception with other cause. And so is it a accumulation of moral choices and substance abuse, or do those moral choices and substance abuse, are they somehow related to the economic exploitation of that community where your natural resources have been taken away from you for use other places? And maybe this is coil where I am approaching at least full on Marxism, if I haven't gotten there. But I think it's a valid way. I mean, I think it's a necessary way to think about the culture that arises in those communities. I think that, so my family being from more like North Central West Virginia, Clarksburg is the town they're from. It's already quite industrialized. The mines were mechanized very early in the 20th century, right? And so jobs, they're still pulling coal out of there, but coal mining jobs were reduced quite a bit. I mean, significantly, exponentially. And so those people who have been accustomed to a mechanical way of life, a mechanized way of life, found it quite easy to go up 77 to Cleveland and Akron and work in the rubber mills and the steel mills, right? And so I think that the economic conditions are not, I can't separate them from the cultural problems that he's talking about, and I think it's, if we're talking chickens and eggs, I would think that the egg would be the economic condition, and the chicken. Well, I don't know how to do a chicken egg.
Well, I know. You mean the chicken, don't you?
But I think the root cause is more economic.
Yeah. One of the.
But how do you?
Sorry. Go ahead, Quill.
I was say, how do you account for, at least in the context of the book, the stories that he gives of the people who get jobs, and then just they'd either rather not have a job, or they lack the ability to hold on to it, or they just don't want to. I mean, what do you do with this large-ish number of people that apparently have access to jobs but don't want them?
I mean, I thought that was I remember that passage, and he talked about that in Middletown, or I think it was in Middletown we talked about. And I feel like you can't just, okay, here's an industry and stick it in this place that has been culturally degraded for generations, right? And expect everybody to automatically adjust, like, socially, right? I think that there are residual,
right.
I mean, I think there's vestigial kinds of cultural lingering effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the very important anecdotes that he tells is, I guess this was the summer before he went to Yale Law School. He was working at like a tile company, and he's doing very hard manual labor, like moving these very heavy pallets of tiles. But he was talking about how it was a great job. The company was doing really well. He was really well paid. In fact, if he was a full-time employee, like he would have been earning, I mean, tens of thousands of dollars. It was like a great job. But then he talks about how he had coworkers, maybe one specific coworker in particular, who had the same job, had this tremendous job, a hard job, but great job, financially lucrative might be a little bit too strong a word, but a great job, and gave it all up just because he was lazy. And he sees that as being this big point. And it's not about the lack of economic opportunity. It's about this culture. Though, you know, my response to that particular anecdote, I think, was similar to yours, Danny, in that I mean, so there is this economic opportunity that's available to this particular person, but then the question is, why doesn't he want to take advantage of it? And of course, I mean, and a lot of it is bound up in culture, but then there's just sort of this question: but why does the culture evolve in this particular kind of a way? And one of the big points that he makes about this culture is just the fact that, and some of the things that come out in when he talks about his experiences at Yale and all of the things that he learned about Yale is just like the defining pathological feature of this hillbilly culture that he's talking about is that it lacks a sense of agency, that people do not feel empowered. And one of the striking things about that is that, like, I mean, of course they don't feel empowered. When you're living in economic circumstances in which there isn't meaningful opportunity, in which you are economically disenfranchised, it's inducing all of this economic stress. And then for one thing, you know, when you experience economic stress, it's no surprise that you turn to drugs and alcohol to sort of alleviate yourself of that. And then that just generates a culture in which people lack agency. So the issue with his friend in this particular anecdote, there's economic available opportunity that's readily available to him in this particular instance. But he himself grew up in this particular culture that lacks this sense of agency and didn't instill in him the particular kinds of habits and virtues that are necessary for economic self-sufficiency. But that culture itself, like, arises out of the kind of economic disenfranchisement that characterizes the parts of the country that he's talking about. Right, it's no surprise that the particular pathologies that he's talking about become most exacerbated when the industries have left Appalachia. Right, so people leave Appalachia and they go on the Great Appalachian Migration to these industrial jobs, but now the industrial jobs in the Rust Belt are leaving, and now we find ourselves in this particular circumstance.
Right, so it's sort of you're saying that the problem is caused by the jobs leaving. But the solution is not giving them jobs.
Well, obviously the solution is giving them jobs. I mean, I don't disagree with him that they're cultural issues there. You know, you, Danny, talked about Moynihan's well-known book. He also talks about William Julius Wilson as well. William Julius Wilson is the great African-American sociologist at Harvard. And I think, like, Wilson himself coined the term underclass, this time to describe the kind of culture in African-American inner-city neighborhoods. And he received a lot of flack in some ways from other African-Americans about sort of talking about this culture of poverty in their cities. But, like, there's definitely a culture of poverty there. But, you know, one thing that's part of Wilson's analysis of, like, the genesis of that culture is that that culture arose when industry left. The story is a little bit more complicated than this, but when industry left those cities, and so you were left with large communities of people that were totally economically disenfranchised, and then you got this particular distinctive culture of poverty in them. And then I would say it's the exact same thing going on in these Appalachian and then Rust Belt communities. So, I mean, like, it's definitely culture, but it's not as if you can divorce culture from the material circumstances that in which it resides.
And it isn't just industry that leaves, right? So human resources also leave. And he talks about the brain drain at some point, right? And this is why I'm a little – and so what's left behind is sort of the culture that's least full of agency, right? And so, I mean, you've sort of that's what a brain drain is. That's why I'm a little underwhelmed by his argument about how rare his situation is. I mean, he talks about Ohio State and having six or seven roommates that all came from the same background as him, right? So, I mean, the people who get out probably do well, right? And so the fact that he got out at all, I mean, it's not like nobody makes it, but it's just mm-hmm. the people that are left are the people who didn't make it, and it just looks worse.
Right. And that's
and then they just transmit their values to their family and everybody in their community. Sorry, go ahead.
There's a great book called Hollowing Out the Middle that's exactly about that. It covers a number of issues, but one of the things it talks about is how these small rural communities basically invest most of what limited resources they have in sort of the best and the brightest to then leave and go to college and move to the city and thus drain the rural communities of you know, the best and the brightest. So you're left with not bad people, but you're left with people who aren't going to be community leaders. They're not going to be organizers. They're not going to be entrepreneurs. They're not going to be the sorts of things that you need a community. You need to have a community thrive. But your point about it's the problem is culture. I think that's sort of the big social takeaway of the book is this problem is cultural. It's not something we're going to be able to solve using politics, passing a law, anything like that. There is nothing the government can do to solve this problem. It's a cultural problem that must be solved from within, which, you know, of course, any cultural problem has to be solved from within. I don't know enough about the history of this particular culture. So we talk about the migration from, you know, Kentucky to Ohio. Well, when the jobs leave Ohio, something in the culture must have changed because there's not another migration, right? Why don't they follow the jobs around? Why is it that one migration and nothing else? Well, again, it's the impression I get from the book is that the problem is cultural. How do you fix a cultural problem? And I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, well, the problem there is that, like, those people can't move to New York and become financiers or to Silicon Valley and become computer programmers.
No, but there are other jobs. There are other places you can move. For some reason, that mobile mentality stopped with the next generation.
I mean, I take exception to that. Cleveland, I mean, maybe it's just because I'm from Cleveland, but Cleveland's population in the 60s was 1 million people, and now it's like 200,000. So Cleveland was emptied out and people went south, where jobs went because there were no unions, right? And so this was yet another sort of economic thing. There was a migration in these big cities.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. And so, I mean, at least in Cleveland, I maybe I'm putting too much of my local experience.
Yeah.
So maybe we're once again left with the people, the story of the people who stayed behind. I mean, so maybe that's just.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about the kind of weird, very difficult to define differences between, say, hillbillies and white trash, right? And, you know, in talking about white trash, we were talking about people who are going to be more prone to violence like that and people who don't have, you know, the gumption or the belief in their own agency to move themselves up. So if you take a person like that who is, you know, a white trash hillbilly and you give them that gumption and you give them a more mature sense of honor, which will let stuff slide, they are no longer white trash. So you have kind of taken them apart from that. And so, you know, unsurprisingly, white trash continues to look the same, right? Because all the people who are no longer defined by that lifestyle have maybe not necessarily moved up in the world, but they have moved on and they are living a different kind of lifestyle. I mean, it's sort of in a sense, whether it's because of lack of agency or because of economic opportunities, and I think, you know, there are these things are joined, right? I think the culture, I'm going to side more with Neil here, Coyle here, and, you know, lay more of it at the feet of the culture, but I think economics has a lot to do with it too, because Appalachia has always been poor, always.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, especially talking about the broader South, you know, you can't get large tracts of land in the Appalachians, so slavery never took off there. So, I mean, in my own home county, you know, the African-American population in the last census was still, I think, in the double digits out of, you know, something like 20 or 30,000 people. And that's just because, you know, historically speaking, slavery it was not a good area to grow large amounts of crops that would require slave labor. And so it was poor even back then, and has continued to be so to this day. Go ahead.
One point that I wanted to make is that, I mean, it's obviously culture, but then it's like, it's not as if culture is separate from material conditions of production. Mm-hmm. Like, one of the things that's really striking about that first migration, I mean, for one thing, it's hard to leave, right?
Right.
It's just hard to leave. But then the second thing is that, like, that migration was driven by the fact that there was this huge industrial boom going on, and that a lot of these companies were coming down into Appalachia and, like, actively recruiting people and getting people to bring them up to work in the factories. It just was all this extremely vibrant economic activity. And like, the economic situation of our country right now is, like, radically different. I mean, there's been tremendous economic growth going on, but all of that – it's an information economy, you know? So you've made money if you are in finance or if you are in the technology industry. But both of those things require extraordinary degrees of resources and education. And, you know, so these places are recruiting, but where are they recruiting? They're not recruiting in Appalachia. They're recruiting in India, right? And talk about brain drain. So we're going to other countries to recruit people with the kinds of technical skills. So there just isn't an opportunity for the second kind of migration among people who lack these skills.
Anything to add to that side of the conversation, I guess, culture versus economics. I mean, obviously culture and economics are related to each other. Hopefully I'm not saying that. I'm glad no one's saying the problem here is politics, because that just makes things a lot easier. I had this long rant I was ready to go on about how politics is not the problem.
Oh, maybe. Okay. Maybe I might alleviate that situation then. I do feel a little embarrassed. I feel like I've had so much to say about this. Partially, I mean, his family history is so close to mine that it's so recognizable. And the fact that he's in Ohio, I just feel like I have so much kind of to spew about this subject. So I apologize if I've gone on too long about things. But I do want to touch on one political, I think, so there is a point, he's clerking at the state house or something like that while he's in college at Ohio State, if I remember.
Right.
And he talks about this bill to rein in payday loans. Do you remember this
right,
section?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And so I remember that. I was still living in Ohio when that was going on. And he was really defending payday loans as a thing,
right,
that government shouldn't interfere with, because it helped me do things without bouncing checks or something like that. Okay, that to me is a political thing where I disagree with him wholeheartedly. I think whenever you see those impoverished communities, you always see in those little plazas, there'll be like a Big Lots, a cigarette store, and a payday loans place, right? I mean, you see those things everywhere you go. And I think payday loans perpetuate the poverty, and they keep people beholden to these corporations to profit on. And I know this from not personal experience, but my family, I had an aunt basically who asked me for a loan, and she's passed now, so she won't be listening to this, but I don't even know if she's an aunt, she's some cousin, you know how hillbillies are. I don't know how I'm related to some of these folks, right? She asked me for a loan. I was like, oh, I'll drive you to the bank and so you can put it in the bank. And she has me drive her to a payday loan place. And I've come to find out that, I mean, this is her bank, right? And that's just totally irresponsible kind of financial planning at the very least. And
right.
I feel like that is a point where government can step in and pull out, or at least limit the effect, the impact of something that's wholly destructive on a community. So I do think there are certain limited political solutions to this. And I agree with you, Coyle, that we're not going to like fund Appalachia out of poverty, right? We're not going to like invent a
right.
program that solves it. But I don't want to like dismiss the political completely, because I think the payday loan thing was a very good thing to limit in inner cities particularly.
Well, can we?
I'm not sure.
Oh,
sorry, go ahead, Jordan.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say, can we, you know, we could also, you know, to take it back to culture here as well. I mean, this is also, you know, politics and culture. And I mean, you were talking about not separating economics from culture, right? I mean, you know, economics comes from the Greek word for housekeeping, politics from, you know, city. So, I mean, you know, all of these things, even when we talk about them separately, they're still intertwined.
Sure.
I'm simultaneously loving this and frustrated. But, I mean, you know, is it not also kind of a cultural thing? Because to kind of with the example of your aunt, Danny, JD talks about joining the Marine Corps and realizing how much he had just never been told.
Right.
You know, the kinds of things, you know, he'd been taught to shoot, but he'd never been taught how to balance a checkbook or what to look for in a good car loan or not to take the loan from the dealership itself. You know, all these things that we would seemingly think are kind of like common economic or even household finance sense that were never imparted to him. And so culturally, you get this kind of, you know, hand to mouth kind of existence where you're just existing from one payday check to the next, taking out advances and loans and things on it like that. There's not much of a sense of resolutely planning something out for the future and sort of sticking with it. You know, even if that opportunity is not immediately available. Being, excuse me, having a kind of mindset to where you would take advantage of something like that when the opportunity presented itself seems to be completely absent.
Yeah, and look, so it's not, they don't teach responsibility, and they don't, I'm trying to think of what how to say the other side of that. What they do have, at least the way Vance presents it, they're often flushing money away on. So, I mean, he talks about buying Christmas presents.
Yeah.
And, like, that section was honestly kind of horrifying to me. Like, he talks about how there's such an emphasis put on having the nicest Christmas presents and more Christmas presents than anyone else. And, like, the newest gadget, or I guess it's probably a little early for technology, but whatever the newest thing is, they're going to have. And if they have to take a payday loan to get it, then that's what they're going to do. And again, that is not the kind of poor I grew up. I mean, our Christmas presents, yeah, we got toys sometimes, but we also got clothes because that's what we needed for the coming year, you know? So there.
Well, and, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, maybe it just all comes back down to this responsibility that culturally is not being passed on. It's not being handed down from one generation to the next. Even though it has to have existed at some point, right? I mean, because they're alive, so there must have been some kind of cultural responsibility in the past. So,
well, I was going to add to that. I mean, I don't know how many times I have myself heard that phrase, "nice Christmas." With all the, he does a nice job of kind of like laying out the freight that phrase carries with it to people from that subculture.
Right.
My brother and I, several years ago, we were at Walmart in my hometown, and, you know, Walmart is kind of it's got a large enough parking lot to allow rednecks to kind of congregate in their trucks. I'm sure y'all have both seen this.
Sure.
And
some of us have done that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, likewise, actually, we were in Walmart one time, and, you know, just these rednecks kind of rumbling by in their, you know, trucks with their lift kits and their glass packs. And we, you know, not just people we're observing, but cousins, you know, relatively close family members and people like that. And we just looked at each other one time and we were like, where do these guys get their money? Because not only are they, you know, really fitting out pickup trucks with all these kind of extra doodads and accessories that are not really useful for anything. I've known plenty of people who have totaled more than one truck per year through reckless driving, getting into accidents. You know, whether or not alcohol was involved is unclear, but probably.
No, it's not.
And then they immediately get another truck and put all the same accessories on it, and they are barely employed, right? So, I mean, I just wanted to throw that in there as well. I mean, these are the kinds of behaviors that Vance is describing and that I've seen in other permutations.
So maybe let's end with that last question there. So having read this book and having talked about hillbillies and white trash and rednecks and so on, what are the policy suggestions that we might have? So again, I don't think politics will fix this. I think religion can fix culture. So what they really need is revival, but you can't make that happen by definition. So that's out of our hands. But is there anything that politically might be done? Do you guys have thoughts on that, or is that too much of a City of Man question and not enough of a sectarian review question?
I don't want to elaborate, but I mean, I think that the religion angle is a little optimistic. Christianity and religion in general has a way of morphing itself to the culture, right? And so I have many, many relatives in Appalachia who proclaim this very bizarre form of Christianity that is not helping them out of their culture, right? And so I feel like...
Well,
and
think of Vance's mama, right?
Yes, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I mean... If it was if we could sort of program a true Christianity, perhaps, right? But you could also cause more problems than you solve with that. And as far as policy, I honestly, that's what's so frustrating about this book is I want to believe that we can do something, but like you said, I don't know. In outside of economic policies that encourage private investment in these places. I don't know what those – I don't know how you solve this. In private investment that is sort of locally controlled so that it isn't just – I mean, even we're talking about in the 50s, industrial cities recruiting people. That's another kind of source resource that they're mining out of that area, right? And so some sort of industrial activity that injects the community with some sort of sense of self-control and agency. I don't know what a policy looks like that. Like I said, this is not my field. But like I know where I live, in the wake of coal mines closing, we see lots of federal and state prisons being built, right? And those employ lots of local people. I mean, I don't know how many people I know that work at prisons now. And so outside of things like that, I really don't know.
Well, I'll throw in, I guess, the two that he specifically suggests are extending, I don't know what the right word for these laws are, but extending caregiver laws, right, to include the broader family. So he talks about how when he was having trouble with the state considering taking him away from his mom, if they had been willing to turn him over to his grandparents, that would have been fine, right? But because the alternative was foster care, and then that's just a random, you get stuck with whoever you get stuck with.
Right.
He lied to the worker, right, and so on, which it's actually, I think it's one of the most interesting parts of the book. So if you haven't read the book, go read it and pay attention to that. Yeah. But counting, having the state recognize that a family is a nuclear family, but it also includes cousins and grandparents and uncles and aunts and so on. So I think that's one thing. He talks about Section 8 housing, which is way too complicated to go in now. But basically, when the government is paying for housing for poor people, there shouldn't be a poor section of town that the government pays for, right? It should be just sort of where everyone else is, right? So there shouldn't be a government project side of town that gets funded. It should be you're given an apartment in a middle-class neighborhood or something like that. And then the one that, having read the book, he doesn't bring this up, but it's definitely something that occurred to me that would not be a guaranteed fix, but I don't see how it would make things worse. Getting rid of no-fault divorce laws. He grows up with just a parade of men through his mother's house. And at least according to the book, his biological dad is genuinely a good person. I don't remember if he was actually married to his mother at any point. But the idea that there is some kind of recognition that a stable family is important, not just to the welfare of the culture, but to, you know, the upbringing of children, and that maybe that should be recognized by the law. That would be a bitter pill for Americans to swallow. And I don't know that I would actually support it in a more general sense, but at least in the context of reading this book, you know, if he had a stable father figure to you know, offset the crazy of the mom, I don't see how that would have necessarily been a bad thing. Again, yeah, arguing the no-fault divorce thing, we could have an episode just on that. Jordan, did you have anything out of that?
It's good. This is going to end with anticlimax because I'm more in Danny's camp. The policy here is frustratingly beyond me, and I again see a lot of this kind of coming back more again and again to kind of culture and various other kinds of irreducibly complicated problems that can't really be addressed with, you know, the kind of magic bullet policy solution. I'd agree that getting rid of no fault divorce would at least help somewhat. I'm a believer in the law of unintended consequences. So sure, what you might see in this day and age is simply people stop getting married at all. Right. Right. At least in this culture. So, I mean, yeah, it's really impossible to say. I don't know what policy solutions would if there are any. And I tend to agree with you that this is something that is more internal, that really has to start with a revolution from the ground up. Right. But if I could propose anything very, very broadly in non-specific terms, I think a greater awareness of, you know, federation or federalism or subsidiarity, trying to get things back down more and more to the local level again, trying to get things down, you know, rather than there being, I don't know, maybe a state, what in Georgia we call DFACS, right? Department of Family and Family and Child Services. Right. Rather than the state kind of, again, zapping kids out of their homes and just depositing them somewhere else in the state with a randomly assigned family, you know, having people more locally involved who know the situation and can proceed with much greater knowledge of the way things are going there, as well as, you know, subsidiarity and other areas of cultural life, even beyond the, you know, the more white trash or hillbilly element that Vance is describing. So that you mentioned Hollowing Out the Middle. Another book I recently read was The Fractured Republic by Yuval Levine, where he kind of talks about the collapse of the mediating institutions that used to be what people like Vance's family could have relied upon for help and that are now largely gone, right? Social clubs, community organizations, local churches. Again, from my own experience, the kinds of people Vance describes would call themselves Christians, but they don't go to church. And so they have cut themselves off from those avenues of help and assistance.
Right.
I don't know. Again, it's frustrating and it really is tragic. And I would, again, further y'all's recommendation that anybody who's listening to this and has not read it, go out and read it, or at least try to catch an interview with J.D. Vance. There's plenty of them on YouTube.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if the concern is that they don't have agency, then we need to encourage them to start going to city council meetings, right? I mean, there are plenty of ways to get involved in local government, which matters so much more than anything the federal government does anyway. I mean, it's there just waiting on people to come along and pick it up. But again, we can't make them do that, right? You can't pass a law that says get involved in the local level. You have to voluntarily go out of your way to happen.
So can I just go back to something that you said earlier, Coyle, about the relationship between culture and politics? That was really illuminating to me and got at something about the difference in the way that conservatives and liberals talk about culture that I've had a hard time putting my finger on. You were getting at something about how culture is ultimately a personal problem, even a religious one. But the idea was that this was all wholly beyond anything that governments can do. This just gets back to the point that Danny was trying to get at earlier. But I don't think that's the right way to think about these cultural problems. If I grew up in an extremely impoverished neighborhood in which there just was no economic opportunity whatsoever, then there's no reason why an ethos of hard work is going to be worth anything to me. There's nothing to encourage that. And this is true if I grow up in rural Appalachia, or industrial Ohio after all of the manufacturing jobs leave, or an inner city African American neighborhood that is similarly hard hit by the loss of manufacturing. And because I'm living under the extreme stress of living hand to mouth, that's going to have all kinds of effects on other parts of my life. So people are going to be more impatient and more prone to anger. Marriages and relationships are going to be harder to sustain under these kinds of conditions of economic need. Substance abuse of all different kinds is going to be really attractive because it's the only thing that provides a little relief from all of the unhappiness and stress in my life. Kids are going to grow up in this environment and they're going to be negatively affected by it all. There's all of this amazing new research on the effects that stress has on the developing brain. But the idea is that stress in a variety of forms can have really long lasting effects on cognitive development. It actually affects IQ and all the kinds of habits and coping mechanisms that people have later in life. One of the more interesting parts of the book was when Vance was talking about having to unlearn all of these coping mechanisms in his relationship with his girlfriend in law school. They're having like all of these problems that sort of trace back to Vance's relationship habits from earlier in his life. So all of that stuff, anger, vice, impatience, substance abuse, laziness, You can say that that's a spiritual problem, and that's true, but it's not like that just comes out of nowhere. You had asked about public policy suggestions, and I totally agree that the problems here are enormously complex. It's a million times easier to break a community than it is to fix a community, but it isn't like these social problems just happen for no reason at all. These Appalachian communities have always been impoverished, and so have also always experienced these attendant social problems. Then when the Appalachian migration happened, that happened because all of a sudden there was an explosion of good manufacturing jobs, and those companies were actively recruiting people out of Appalachia. And those hardworking, working-class folk came with all of their attendant social problems from back home. But they were doing well because they had all these good jobs, but then those manufacturing jobs left, and they were left in economic circumstances that were just going to revive or magnify all of the social problems that they had back in Appalachia and spread them around to a whole new group of people who weren't from Appalachia but were experiencing similar kinds of economic stress. So all of that is a cultural problem. It's a spiritual problem. It's a personal problem. But it's not like that just happens. It happens in a social and economic context that's affected by political decisions that people make. And there just is going to be no recovery for those communities, whether we're talking about Appalachian communities or working white class communities in Rust Belt, Ohio, or again, African American city communities in the inner city. There's just going to be no recovery that isn't also accompanied by an economic recovery. And while our economic problems are enormously complex, having to do with technological change and globalization and all of that, not just political, but partially political, they're affected by our political decisions. And I'm not saying that there's some kind of silver bullet answer that's just going to solve all of these problems. But politically, we can do things, and some things are going to make the problems better, and some things are going to make the problems worse. I'm kind of preaching there, so I should probably shut up. And this episode has been going on a lot longer than probably it needs to. We should try to wrap things up. And one thing that we often do is in our episodes is talk about further readings or other things that might be interesting to people. Do you guys have any suggestions for books or resources that we haven't already talked about?
I'll throw in one short piece. I had hoped to bring this up later, or at least another piece by the same author. I know I've mentioned him before, Kevin Williamson. He writes for National Review. I had a very interesting piece several years ago that was the first real journalistic recognition I had seen of the kinds of problems Vance is describing. But it was a long-form piece for National Review called The Tragedy of the Hollows, in which he visits towns like the one Vance has described. I think he stays in the mountains, but a lot of the things Vance describes, like people buying soda with their food stamps and then reselling it to get cash for other stuff, Williamson describes. I would definitely part ways with Williamson on his verdict of the book because he came down very, very hard on these communities in another later piece saying that, you know, these communities have failed. They need to die. The people need to go join a community that actually works. Missing Vance's larger point that the people move, but they take their culture with them, right? That's the one piece I would recommend. It's called The Tragedy of the Hollows. I think it's available free online. And then the other books that y'all have mentioned.
Danny, you got anything else?
Well, like I said, I think I've kind of mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned on the air or not, one book about the Scotch-Irish that's quite good. It's an academic book. It's called The People with No Name by Patrick Griffin. It is actually a really good kind of history of that migration. I think it adds some complication to that identity that he leaves out. I'm going to do something that'll probably make Coyle's blood boil, but there is a
Communist Manifesto. Communist Manifesto.
No. There was a close. There was a Jacobin piece about this book that is a fair review. I think it's a fair a critique of his reliance on the culture of poverty argument. And I can't remember the name of it, but if you just look, search for his name on Jacobin's website, you'll find it. So,
I will say I actually enjoy that website. They are leftist, but they're occasionally the good kind of leftist.
Yeah.
Like they sneak some classical liberalism in there, and I'm not sure that's just like getting by the editors or what have you. But all right, well, thanks so much, guys. We should do this crossover thing again.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks so Definitely. Much.
Well, you have wasted another perfectly good hour listening to us. The City of Man podcast, as well as the Sectarian Review, are both proud members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. For more information about any of the shows in that family, check out christianhumanist.org. Please like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. Leave us feedback there or email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. And on behalf of Coyle, Jordan, Danny, and myself, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high